Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. It's the voice of a patriot. It's the voice of someone who's willing to talk truth to power. He assured his father it would be all right. And of course, we've come to expect that nothing is all right until perhaps change happens in November of 2020. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Things are getting tight in Texas, Mr. Braddock. Everything I'm reading about suggests that maybe Cornyn is getting nervous, that Trump is getting nervous. Mm-hmm. And the best way to tell is if they up the number of people that are showing up for the Biden campaign in Texas, because that's usually an indicator that they smell something as well.
Last polling I saw, and we may have touched on this a little bit last week, Arnie, but you know, there's one poll after another and they all sort of start to run together. But public policy polling just last week had the Democratic challenger to John Cornyn within 4 points. Cornyn was at 44, she was at 40. MJ Hager is the Democrat, and everybody's on TV now. It's after Labor Day, all the television ads are up. And in the U.S. Senate race, it is fascinating. The Republican senator who has been there for decades now, you know, in statewide office in Texas, who is, according to polling earlier this year, not well known. Look, John Cornyn is not as well known a quantity as Ted Cruz, who is a, you know, national sort of figure, a flamethrower. Everybody knows the Tea Party senator who, you know, exactly walked into this years ago, decades ago in the Senate. If someone had walked in as a freshman senator and behaved the way he did, they might have gotten physically harmed by one of the other senators. In the beginning of Master in the Senate, Master of the Senate, Robert Caro, writing about the Senate in the beginning of that thing, and just fascinating to see that, you know, in the, I guess in the 1800s, if a senator who was a freshman tried to speak to a senior senator, there was one example where one of the senators took, I think, their walking stick and struck the guy's clavicle and broke it.
Oh, no.
Because the senator was speaking, and then some people got to know Ted Cruz, and they thought, could we bring that back? So you've got Cornyn, who is not as well known. He's not a flamethrower. He is somebody who's, of course, known among Republicans. A lot of Democrats don't have as much reason to just hate him the way they do with Cruz, although, of course, Cornyn is not their favorite. But Cornyn has been, I think, in a way, grasping for straws of what he should talk about and what his message would be. If you asked any Texan today, what's the message from the Cornyn campaign? Why is it he should be reelected? I think they would struggle to tell you the answer. The very first advertisement I saw on television from Cornyn, which was running last week, a first TV ad for the general election this year, he was focused in on helping rape victims and a bill that he helped pass to speed up the backlog of rape kits, which of course is an important issue, but is that top of mind for people? Everybody's talking about what?
Oh, I know. This is the suburban housewife vote.
Et cetera. It's a suburban vote and it's the woman vote. Right. I mean, we're reaching out to women with something like this. I don't know if the ad is effective or not, just because it's not about the things that people are already talking about, at least top of mind. You know, when you have I would describe it as economic anxiety. You know, we have a lot of people in this state still who are out of work. You have a governor who today, we tape on Thursday, is supposed to be announcing more lifting of restrictions as it pertains back to you. But that's the thing that people are focused on. And what happened with that? I don't think Cornyn wants to talk about the state and federal response to coronavirus. The governor, as we've talked about, has seen his approval ratings during the virus drop from almost 70% to around 40% for his coronavirus response. He was at 35% for his coronavirus response in a poll that was just out this week. Meantime, you have a Democrat who is also not well known. This is why I think in this race, and let's focus in on the Senate race for a little bit. I don't know that we've talked about it that much here. Maybe there's sort of an even playing field. If people don't really know Cornyn, which that's what the polling shows, which is just fascinating. He was attorney general. He was on the Texas Supreme Court before that. Now he's a United States senator and has been, you know, since the early 2000s. Back in the day, Cornyn running against Ron Kirk when he first won that seat. Ron Kirk, the former mayor of Dallas, African-American Democrat. That was the year that the national media was saying, I think, that, what was that, 2003 or maybe 2002, the national media was saying, you know, Texas is about to turn blue.
Right.
So that's how long we've been watching that, Arnie. But Cornyn, not well known, and Hager, Major Hager, not well known either. She was running a television ad this past week. It's pretty visually stunning, and she's talking about the way she earned the Purple Heart in Afghanistan. You know and have probably seen the story of her. They were battling the Taliban in Afghanistan when they, as she put it, they fought like hell to get everybody out of this situation. One day when she strapped herself to the bottom of a helicopter and she was returning fire on the Taliban as they were coming after her, the ad shows her on a hillside in Afghanistan, one of those rocky hills, and in the background you see the helicopter on fire. And she's talking about how she's still going to fight like hell because Texas families are still in danger from there. It's a bio piece, though, and we're past Labor Day. And she's been talking about that story very publicly, of course, since 2 years ago when she first ran for Congress in the Austin area and came close to but did not beat a Republican incumbent. I guess the point I would make with that is that tells me that her campaign must have a poll that says that people have not heard that story, right? That they don't know who she is. So they're having to introduce the Democratic candidate to people now in September. We have two candidates who are kind of on even footing as far as whether people know who they are, know anything about them, and both of them are kind of struggling for a message.
Well, let me just say something, though. I think people are looking for courage. So that ad shows courage. I think that
to take away from her story at all.
No, she won
the Purple Heart for that, right, and she's a decorated veteran and everything. Right. I just do think it means that people don't know the story. I would be troubled by that if I was on the Democratic side saying, oh, wow, we have a real shot to win this race.
Right. And at the same time, you've got a senator, a Republican senator, where Mitch McConnell is not willing to bring back anything in the way of financial support for, you know, struggling small business or people that are have lost their jobs. So he can't point to anything economically, Cornyn, that he is able to deliver for Texas. And MJ Hager can suggest what they would do if the Democrats controlled the Senate and if Biden were elected, because she can suggest offering so many economic bailouts that clearly both Trump and McConnell are not doing. So to a large extent, both her courageous, you know, biopic, and then this sort of, you know, completing the sentence, to me, that's a 1-2 punch that Cornyn has no response for. None. Just the fact that he's there. That's it. And he's been there for a long time. Yippee-doo. That's a reason to vote for him? I don't think so. Not at the time of a pandemic and an economic downturn.
It's a tough time for anybody who's an incumbent right now. I think that's true for Republicans and Democrats, by the way. In Texas, it just happens to be the Republicans. And nationally, it happens to be the Republicans. You know, and thinking about the way this whole thing has gone, if you didn't have a president who was so herky-jerky with his response and all over the place and trying to explain what he said to Bob Woodward about this being a deadly thing that you can just breathe through the air, Bob. It's not like the touch. You don't have to touch things. Remember this thing about you don't have to touch. You can avoid the touch, but if it's breathing at you, or, you know, if somebody's breathing at you and you can get it, that's one thing, which is not what he was saying publicly. Senator Cornyn, on a conference call with journalists last week, struggled to answer questions about what President Trump had said in that interview with Woodward versus what he was saying in other settings. Let's say the president was doing everything right, though. Let's say you could do a poll, and the vast majority of people would say that the president had handled the situation well, but things were still going badly, right? That the death count was continuing to rise.
They would forgive him.
I'm sorry?
They would forgive him.
No, I don't think so. My point is that even if an office holder was doing things right, but the situation was terrible, it would still be tough for the incumbent to win. When things are going badly, you might have some sympathy for the incumbent, but you might say, you know what, maybe they're not the right one for the job. We need to get somebody else. And so I do think that that puts the president and it puts John Cornyn and other Republicans who can easily be tied to President Trump in a tough position.
It's going to be so interesting. So let's talk about who Biden is adding to his staff in Texas, because I hear that the number is 13. I was looking at an article, I think from the Dallas Morning News. So that's a significant number, but I think you really want to sort of focus on who these people are, because maybe they have a profile that we might recognize or might have some significant influence in Texas politics.
Actually, I would say that these are folks who are well-known around the Texas Capitol complex, but probably not well-known anywhere else. There were a few people in there that are just veterans of Texas politics and do know the lay of the land. What it tells me is that the Biden campaign is finding people who do know what they're talking about in Texas, which has not always been the case with presidential campaigns and other national campaigns when they've come in to run things in Texas. We still, though, don't see any real investment in Texas as far as any kind of resources, any kind of advertising, anything like that from the Biden campaign. Of course, they're choosing to spend their money. I think I saw the report. It was six swing states. Of course, none of those are Texas. There are places like Pennsylvania and Arizona, I think Nevada, and of course, Florida. You did see the big announcement about Bloomberg is going to spend $100 million in Florida, which, you know, you do hit a saturation point this close to the election. You're trying to spend that kind of money. However, that can help to move the needle in a place like Florida, which if Biden can deny Trump Florida or make him work harder in Florida, that takes his eye off the ball in other places because, as I understand it, as you understand it, and others know this is the case, there's not a path to the White House for a Republican without Florida, but a Democrat can get there without the Sunshine State.
So let me just say something, though. The $100 million that Bloomberg will be spending, you talk about saturation, but you're assuming sort of generic advertising, TV advertising, Facebook
That's
advertising.
That's most of what it would be.
Right. But there'll be
ground game and a mail ballot program
right.
as well.
But I also think Bloomberg will be doing incredible targeting. He has got so much in his sort of portfolio about who to focus on and to sort of almost create individual messages for different families and different addresses, that $100 million is going to be, I think, effectively spent. And that's just my assumption about Bloomberg. I may be wrong, but I don't think so. Since we are talking about, you know, the election, let's talk about what Joe Strauss did, because your former Speaker of the House wrote a very powerful op-ed, and it was entitled, Texas Should Stop Fighting Vote by Mail and Accommodate People Who Need the Option. He came out swinging on something that Republicans have been pushing so hard against, because if you listen to Bill Barr, the AG, if you listen to Donald Trump, the last thing they want to talk about is the integrity of vote by mail. And here is Strauss suggesting the exact opposite.
Strauss, who is a, you know, one of the sort of establishment Republicans who retired on his own terms 2 years ago as Speaker of the House, came out in the Dallas Morning News and said that a state that refuses to recognize the unique circumstances of the moment is failing its citizens. We've talked here on the show about the big fight in Houston, which is where this is really going down of this fight in Texas. And in a lot of ways, it's a big story for the nation. I saw Vice News on HBO last night. They were featuring the Harris County clerk, which, you know, I've covered the clerk's office in Harris County in Houston, Texas for many years. I didn't think it would be the epicenter of a big national fight about anything. It's pretty boring. But the clerk's office has been saying that what they wanted to do was, and look, the president has talked about those states where they're sending out ballots to people. I guess they're doing that in Michigan and maybe some other places where the ballots are just going out. And he says, you know, they're sending it to dead people. They're sending it to dogs. I don't think they're sending it to dogs, but that's the way he said it. Who knows? Maybe he knows something that we don't. Maybe it's in Bob Woodward's
book. Bob Woodward. Yeah, I doubt it.
I'm not sure. But in Texas, and this is what Strauss was talking about. This is what the Harris County clerk, who's a Democrat, is talking about. They're talking about sending out the application to then ask for your mail ballot. And the big thing about voter integrity and ballot integrity here is that if you have a copy of the application, which the government would have, then they have a record of who asked for the ballot. You know, this is one extra step to make sure that there is that sort of security when it comes to the ballot. And you have a Republican Party chairman, Alan West, who some call Florida man, the former Florida congressman, who has been saying that there's a big difference between absentee balloting and voting by mail, which he's being less than truthful. It's the exact same thing in Texas. There's no difference. In fact, in Florida and Texas, the statute was changed such that, I know in Florida it was changed such that it's exactly the same. They did have some slight difference according to the law previously, but not anymore. And of course, Alan West, when he was a congressman in Florida, ran a mail ballot program because that's how Republicans win
God.
That's how Republicans win in Florida.
Hypocrisy is making me vomit.
Well, Republican operatives will tell you that the Florida Republican Party has a very successful vote by mail program. And in fact, the Democrats struggle to keep up with it.
So am I hearing
usually it's the case that in Florida, the Republicans...
Go on.
Well, the Republicans in Florida will dominate the vote in mail ballots, and then Democrats usually have to catch up on Election Day with in-person voting in Florida. In Texas, the Republican Party of Texas, led by Alan West, is sending out what? They're sending out forms for people to fill out and get their ballot to vote in the mail. On the front of the mailer from the Texas GOP, it's got President Trump's picture, and it says, President Trump wants you to fill out this form. Now, Alan West put out a video just in the last couple of weeks where he talked about the idea, sort of conspiracy theory style, that Democrats want to send out these applications to their list. He says, you don't know who's on their list, you know, sort of trying to sow doubt about who would be getting these applications. Well, you know that what the Republican Party is doing, smartly, is they're looking at voter history in Texas, and we don't register people by Democratic or Republican parties in Texas, but you can look at whether people voted in Republican or Democratic primaries. Right. And, of course, they're sending vote-by-mail applications to people who have voted in multiple Republican Party primaries. So they're trying to pump that up on one side and keep the folks in Houston from sending these mail ballot applications out to people. And look, if the polls are right, we've talked about this, but it's worth repeating. If the polls are anywhere close to reality, and we'll find out together whether that's true, if we really have a race for president in Texas that is separated by one percentage point, which some of these polls show, and in fact, one of the polls showed that Biden was up by 1 point, which I don't believe that, but let's say it's really close. Everything the Republican Party is doing in Texas is telling me that they believe that it's a very close race in Texas, that whether it's the mail ballot issue in Houston, and let's underscore this, the Harris County area, the Houston area, is home to 1/5 of the state's electorate out of a state of 30 million people. It tells you how big Houston is. It's as big as some states. Harris County is as big as Georgia, basically. If you can sow doubt and create a legal framework for challenging ballots in Harris County, and let's say it comes down to Biden wins Texas by 1 point. Let's play it out. Where would you go to court? You'd go to court in Houston, and you'd say, you know what, there's a whole bunch of these ballots that are not legitimate because a whole bunch of people got the registration forms that they shouldn't have been able to get those things, and we've got to invalidate all of these votes. Texas could become the Florida from 2000. It could become the Florida of 2020 if that was to happen, because what's on the line? 38
electoral votes.
Electoral votes. There is no path to the presidency for a Republican if Texas is to flip. Now, I would add one other thing to that. The Republican and Democratic parties in Texas have been having this war in the courts over mail ballots, but also over who can be on the ballot. They have gone back and forth about trying to kick the Libertarians and the Green Party off of the ballot in Texas. The Libertarians won their case with the Republicans. The Libertarians are still on the ballot. The Green Party lost their case at the appeals court this past week, so that the Green Party candidates were kicked off the ballot. All Republican Texas Supreme Court just 2 days ago reversed the appeals court and said that the Secretary of State, with time running out to get ballots out to millions of people, the Texas Supreme Court said that the Secretary of State needed to do everything they could do to put the Green Party candidates back on the ballot. So you tell me, the Greens are back, Arnie. You tell me, and you know they were fist in the air, the Greens are back, but you tell me if that doesn't tell you that Republican leadership in this state, you know, that they're not worried about, you know, an election that's going to be within 1 or 2 points. Everything is down to the margins around here.
Right. Well, absolutely. I mentioned this to Stephanie, and Stephanie made a comment. She said, have you noticed that there are a lot of Republicans running in New Hampshire, and they don't mention the Republican Party on their signage in front of houses, and they're actually colored blue. They're not even red, they're blue. And the reason I even mentioned that to you, Scott Braddock, is that you mentioned that GOP candidates for Congress in suburban Texas are suddenly all running as, shock of shock, moderates. Let me wash my mouth out with soap, who are effective and even better bipartisan. I want to play Kumbaya. This is unbelievable.
The list of candidates is kind of stunning of Republicans who say that they're moderate and bipartisan and effective. Michael McCaul, who is a pretty conservative Republican, Republican congressman from the Austin and Houston area, his district runs from Austin to Houston, if I was to drive the length of the district, it would take about 2.5-3 hours, something like that. That's how our districts look in Texas. But then you also have Roy, who comes right out of the school of Ted Cruz. As far as politics, Chip Roy was a former aide to Ted Cruz, and he's been somebody who's very on board with Cruz's style of politics. But his television advertisement, you wouldn't know that. He says that he challenges his party when they're wrong, and he works with Democrats when it's right for Texas. In McCall's district, the campaign signs don't include the word Republican. In suburban Houston, Texas, in Katy, which is just to the west of Houston, legislative candidates are not using Republican, the word Republican on their campaign signs, and those signs are blue also. And so that's happening all over the place, where the Republican brand is just trashed in some of these places where it used to be the thing that you would run on. All you had to do in suburban Texas would say, you know, once you got to the general election, was say that you were the Republican. As one of my friends put it, to win a general election in Texas for decades, all you really had to do was avoid being the Democrat. That's not the case anymore. Now it's much more nuanced than that, an interesting discussion happening about which issues. One other thing, Arnie, there's something very interesting about the kind of red meat that Republicans are now putting forth for the electorate. And let me see if I can articulate this. It used to be that the red meat that Republicans would throw out there for the base was things like immigration crackdowns and anti-abortion legislation, the kind of things that maybe in other parts of the country would split the electorate 50-50, or would, and if you did polls on this. But no, the kind of red meat that Republicans are using now is the kind of thing that if you don't know much about the issue, for example, what I'm saying is, the idea of red meat has shifted up a little bit, where they're trying to make it something that's palatable to everyone. So one thing would be defending the police, right? When you say that Democrats are wrong to want to defund the police, what do Democrats immediately say? They say, well, we don't want to defund the police. In other words, they can't help themselves, are tripping over themselves to agree with Republicans that they don't want to defund the police. Here's another one. Last year, there was a bill passed in the Texas legislature to preserve the life of babies that have already been born. The Born Alive Act is something they passed that Democrats were not in favor of because they saw this as another attack on a woman's right to choose. However, they did not vote against it. They all voted, they white lighted it in the Texas House. All these white lights were, they were voting present but not voting because they didn't want to be against the bill that said that, you can't murder a baby. Right?
Wait, stop. You can vote present? You don't have to pick one way? Sure. Oh, that's not allowed in New Hampshire. Wow.
You guys are extreme.
Oh, wow. I just learning and that.
There was only one Democrat from Houston, Texas, Harold Dutton, the chairman of the Family Issues Committee, who voted no on the Born Alive Act. But the point I'm making is that Republicans are figuring out a way to put things out there that still fire up their base, but they put Democrats in the position of not being able to be against the thing the Republicans are pushing.
What about the story about the hysterectomies and the doctor of the immigrants that are coming in?
How are the
Democrats using this issue? You mentioned immigration. You mentioned Born Alive. This kind of blends those two stories together because this is an immigration story, but it's a hysterectomy story, which to me is just, I mean, it feels like Nazi Germany if it turns out to be true. So I'm just wondering if that story has started to thread itself into the conversation in Texas.
You know, you don't see it in television advertisements. You don't really hear it from the candidates. Immigration is, I think at this point, at least for this cycle, seems to be kind of a dead issue. I don't see the Democrats really going there. That's not what they're getting their base fired up about. Of course, if they were asked about the story you're talking about, they would
be horrified,
be disgusted. They would be. Almost everybody would be. But it's not the thing that they're organizing people around.
Well,
which I think is a mistake if they want to get the young Latino vote out.
Well, let me just say something. The story is still young and new, and I think people are trying to figure out whether it's real or Memorex, and they're looking to make sure that if they do come out swinging, they do put it in ads. It's more than just a toxic story. They have the facts to support it, and I suspect, especially as you were saying, that a lot of these candidates are trying to talk about their bipartisanship, and they're talking about all this stuff, and they're the supporters of life. This is a story that undermines so much of what they articulate, so I think that's really important. Really quick, I only have a minute left.
Okay.
So you mentioned something about the fact that the lieutenant governor is worried about the Texas Senate grinding to a halt in January?
No, he's not worried about it. He's saying that's what's going to happen. So there was a conference call with the lieutenant governor and the chairman of committees in the Texas Senate where Dan Patrick, who remember on Fox News, said that the elderly might need to sacrifice their lives for the economy. However, when it comes to him personally, he thinks that they should basically maybe be like in a bubble like the NBA. that when they convene in January, if the pandemic is still raging, then he wants to cut off public participation in the legislative process, and he wants to make sure lobbyists can't come in, and basically that the senators are distanced from everybody else in Texas, which a lot of people thought was pretty hypocritical, but it will change some things about the way folks interact with the legislature. And if you're cutting, I'll say this real fast, if you're cutting off public access to the Texas Capitol at a time that they're considering legislation, my veteran lobbyist said to me yesterday, there's an immediate constitutional challenge to anything that gets passed during the legislative session. You can't keep the people out of the process.
Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it's Friday, it must be Texas and it must be Braddock. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk next week. Ciao.
Thanks, Arnie.
All right. Stick around, everyone. A little Stefan Schmidt is next.
Insight Daily Radio.
As we sail into the mystic.
Rob Bell is the author of 10 books, including the New York Times bestseller, What We Talk About When We Talk About God, and What is the Bible? The former pastor of the Mars Hill Bible Church in West Michigan, he has since been profiled in The New Yorker and toured with Oprah Winfrey. His latest book is Everything is Spiritual, Who We Are and What We're Doing Here. In this compelling and surprisingly subversive memoir, he takes us through his history and the history of the universe to show us something about each, how all of it matters, how everything we've been through forms a connected whole, and how it's all been headed somewhere the whole time. We spoke with him about the book.
I was curious about the big questions from an early age. One of the things I do in the book is just trace that curiosity. I ended up playing in a band. I was the lead singer, and then the band broke up because I ran into jobs. And I went to seminary because I was like, that's a place where you can get some answers. I mean, they literally have a master's of divinity degree, which I laugh at now to be a master of the divine. But I went and got one of those degrees, then I got a job at a church. So I kept following this sense that there's more going on here, the sense that it's a big, vast universe. And I kept finding hints and glimpses all over the place, from quantum physics to art to the earth to the ocean. I kept seeing more and more of this expansive, miraculous experience we're all having. So one of the things I do in the book is explore. What you really want isn't necessarily success or money or fame. What we all actually want is wonder and awe about our own existence.
That's best-selling author Rob Bell, whose latest book, Everything is Spiritual, Who We Are, and What We're Doing Here, has just been released. Insight Daily Radio.
Have to look good, I don't have to.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part deux of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other week, we hang out with Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics in Iowa, a retired, is this true, a retired professor of political science at Iowa State, but I can't imagine that you stay away too far from your students. I mean, you've been doing this for decades.
No, I'm called emeritus, which I don't know what that means, but it means I still have a whole bunch of students I'm working with, master's theses, I'm doing more media than ever, so it doesn't feel like retired, honestly. It feels like I'm staying away from the infected students at Iowa State, and that's about it.
Oh, my goodness. Actually, that's a really good point. What is going on with Iowa? I mean, your governor she seems like she's in la-la land. It turns out that you have all this devastation from climate change with the derecho or whatever it is, that huge wind. You have issues with COVID where you're seeing incredible spikes and the governor's insisting that people go back to school. You're watching what's happening on college campuses. And of course, young people think that they're invincible and they can party and therefore they spread the disease. We're worried about the fall because the fall is going to be more acute for both the pandemic, for the regular flu, for what happens when people, you know, are in enclosed areas. And then, of course, we're still worried about climate change because all you have to do is take a look at what's going on in the Gulf in Florida and seeing how many inches of rain because the hurricane moves so slowly, or you watch the fires that they say on the West Coast will continue to burn through the winter. So I'm looking at Iowa and I'm trying to figure out how does a Republican survive given what your governor is now, which is a poster child for everything that I think actually harms Iowa economically and harms it from a healthcare perspective. So explain Iowa to me right now, Stefan.
Donald Trump. I mean, she's a Republican. The legislature is Republican. The 4th district will probably go to a Republican who is challenged and defeated in the primary, Steve King. And even the White House sent Governor Reynolds, our governor, an urgent message saying, you got to tell people to wear masks and you've got to allow the White House. Because she is the worst in terms of that. She is indecisive. But we do have Chuck Grassley, who is the most senior senator in the country and is a Republican and is very loyal and doesn't want to rock the boat and doesn't want to offend Donald Trump. And I think it honestly all has to do with, you know, the fear of conservatives, evangelicals, and others who do actually believe that masks are a democratic hoax and that they don't help you. And so there is just a lot of, let's call it, complete uncertainty because some cities, the mayors and the city councils are just saying, we're going to have a mask requirement, even though the governor says it's illegal. And the colleges, frankly, if the governor doesn't say you got to wear masks, you know, Iowa State students, there was a wonderful interview on public radio with an editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education who was in Ames. Yeah. And they asked him about it. He said, well, I went around town and I talked to shop owners and barkeepers. He said, I was shocked. He said, the bars were full of people. The restaurants were full of people. He said, no one was wearing a mask. And so, of course, those students, they're not catching it in the classroom. They're not catching it on any campus, you know, laboratories because
they're catching it in the bar.
We are requiring very strict masks and sanitation and distance and, but they catch it in town and then they come to work and bring it with them. So
doesn't Ames have a mask mandate? I mean, how can you have Iowa State, you know, basically cracking down, asking people to physically distance, asking them to wear a mask, doing all this stuff to make them quote unquote safe. And of course, they're not going to be, you know, hermetically sealed on campus. They are going to go shopping. They are going to go to a bar. So hasn't Ames passed a mask mandate in order to support Iowa State? Or do they not give a crap? And then all of a sudden, all these kids are going to get COVID. And here's the sad part, Stefan. We are now learning more and more about COVID. Even if you survive it, you might have lung damage. You might have heart damage. No, I don't care. I'm going to be 67 in a week and a half. So I will die in the next 10 or 15 years. These people have 40 years ahead of them. Yeah, I see you wearing the mask.
I'm putting on my mask.
I know, but look, I'm shocked. I'm shocked.
If our listeners could see it, they would see that the mask is Iowa State University mask. It also comes in beautiful black. And they are also issuing shields and a package of disposable masks. The city council debated and talked about and then voted, and it was not unanimous, but they did vote a mandate on masks, but no penalties. No. So nobody cares. I mean, it's like saying, we have a suggestion, drive 65 miles an hour on this highway. And I think that doesn't work. I think, you know, most people obey when they think there is something negative, something that's going to punish them. So
it's shocking. So the other thing that's shocking is Bill Barr. I know that this whole question of the vote is trying to be undermined by Donald Trump. He wants to make sure that nobody trusts the results, no matter what the result is, because the only result that he can trust is the result that says he wins. But this has always been kind of the theme of the Republican Party, because the Republican Party has been the party of voter suppression. I mean, they really, really have. They've done everything to make it very difficult, especially for certain people, to be able to exercise the franchise. But now you have the Attorney General of the United States putting out stuff that is patently false. And he is aiding and abetting the president in these incredible lies. And it just, it's beyond shocking. I mean, his behavior has been so depressing anyway, but now this sort of overt behavior about raising questions about how people will pack the vote and how do you know and your dog will vote and all, I mean, this stuff, it sounds like something that you would sort of read on a far, you know, far left or far right, to be honest with you, but it's coming out of the Attorney General. How do you impeach him? How do you muzzle him? But you can't, because you only have weeks to go.
The Attorney General, most people don't realize this, Arnie, is not actually an employee of the President of the United States. He is the top law enforcement officer in the country, and he's supposed to be there to look after the interests of all Americans, any Americans. You're supposed to look at the laws and look at facts. And this is extraordinary. But then again, we're living in a moment that is, I think, unprecedented in American history and in American politics. And so, again, I come back to the question, is there any sanction or punishment for the Attorney General for doing things that are dangerous for the country? And the answer is no.
Yeah,
there is none. The Senate is as silent as a stone. The U.S. Senate, dominated by the Republicans. The Democrats are not even themselves doing a whole lot. But the Republicans just are silent on all these things. And you can't imagine that they're not actually informed enough to know that this is very dangerous. Because, you know, if a Republican ever is not president, and you have a Democrat president, and you have a Congress that is controlled by the Democrats, the precedent has now been set for an incredible amount of malicious activities on the part of the executive branch. And I always taught in my classes that in the United States, we have this very delicate balance between the huge power of the executive branch, but the checks of the Senate and the House and the courts that sort of keep in check what is actually almost dictatorial power that is given to the president in the Constitution. The president can interpret it any way he wants. And most presidents have been careful not to go too far because they get smacked, they get slapped on the wrist and told, no, you can't do this. And when you let a kid run amok, regardless of what the rules of the house are, or you let your dog run crazy and they don't have a consequence, they'll keep running crazy. And so we are in a moment that is, it's hard to predict where it will end and what's on the other side of it. If President Trump wins the election by a significant margin, all of these things will be confirmed and essentially legitimized, right? Mm-hmm. Because, right, you know, the voters have said, we don't care, we like this. But most people don't understand the consequences, so, you know.
Dahlia Lithwick writes for Slate.com, Stefan, And she had just an amazing piece that was in the Slate on Thursday morning. And let me just read a couple of sentences from it, just because it just adds to the integrity of this conversation. And she said, in recent days, Barr appears to have inched away from his earlier claims that voting by mail was uniquely susceptible to foreign election tampering. That used to be the argument. Here's the new argument. You ready? This is from Bill, same guy, Bill Barr. But the foreign tampering story is not sufficient to his purposes. So Barr has definitely turned his sights once again on the enemy within. His newest claim seems to be that it's Americans, not foreigners, who will steal the 2020 election by buying, selling, browbeating, and intimidating otherwise good and honest voters who attempt to vote by mail. This is like incredible. Don't worry about the foreigners. It's you. And then he says, in that same CNN interview, Barr was testing the new theory that it would be domestic, not foreign enemies who will tamper with mail-in ballots. While he had no idea how often this new vote harvesting thing had occurred, saying it here, it's vanishingly rare that this could even be proved, Barr asserted that, quote, we indicted someone in Texas, someone, let me repeat the word, someone in Texas who had stolen 1,700 ballots. He made them out and voted for the person he wanted to, he told Blitzer. That claim was also later confirmed as false. Okay? So I just, This is coming out of the United States Attorney General. This is not QAnon. This is not the KKK. This is not, you know, Boogaloo Boys. This is the Attorney General. And he actually said that, and it turned out to be false. It is shocking. And that's why Dahlia Lithwick's piece, I would turn that into a freaking ad. Just read it out loud.
But the other thing the Democrats could have done is said, well, we understand that that person who stole all those ballots was a Republican. And the other thing is, you know, that obviously these threats only really apply to Democrats, progressives, socialists, but Republicans can vote remotely and with absentee ballots and be very honest and not cheat, because that the implication is obviously that, you know, because as Scott Braddock says in Texas and in Florida, I know this is true. I lived in Florida many years. I went to school there. You know, elderly people in Florida love voting by absentee ballot. And a lot of them are Republican. I mean, you know, and I've seen analyses which say this is not really a great idea, because if Republican voters think that absentee ballots are going to be fudged, they may decide not to vote at all rather than go to a polling place and catch COVID. And so, you know, this could be a self-defeating in a way. You know, you just don't know. I don't think.
But he doesn't care.
Barr has the data.
But there is, so here's the problem. This isn't about self-defeating. Donald Trump wants the chaos of the election, because the chaos of the election is how, no matter what the outcome is, Stefan, he can use it to his advantage. If he wins, it's the mandate. If he loses, it lacks integrity. It doesn't have authority. And as everyone said, every lawyer in America is going to be employed because of this election. It's going to be Bush v. Gore times 15,000, because there are going to be that many cases happening everywhere. And that's what's so frightening about this too, is look at how long it took for one Bush v. Gore to be decided. Imagine all these mini Bush v. Gores happening in counties, in cities and towns, in states around the country, because Donald Trump wants to make sure that this result is delayed if he loses. And I keep saying that the one thing he has to happen is he has to lose in the polls, he has to lose on election day, and he has to lose after all the mail-in votes are counted. And if it isn't a trifecta, there's no way he's going to be convinced that he loses. And Biden suggested that the military might march him out. I don't want the military involved in this. Biden, shut up. Are you listening to me, Joe? I want to march him out is Mitch McConnell. I want Mitch McConnell to march him out. I want the Supreme Court Justice, you know, Roberts, to march him out. I don't want the military involved in any way, shape, or form with Donald Trump.
Well, that is, of course, having grown up in Latin America, how we do things there. That, you know, when politics fails in Latin America, the military always said, we are the guardians of the Constitution. And therefore, since things are falling apart, we need to step in and basically straighten out these civilian politicians. And you see that in Argentina, you see that in Brazil, you see that in Peru and in many countries. When politics fails, there are other ways of running a country. And those involve non-elected individuals who think that they are above all of this. Politics is a dirty game, for sure. But politics is the best we have in terms of solving issues and presenting alternatives and getting people involved and not doing it from the superior, you know, turrets up there of the military. So, you know, that's not a good idea. No. I think
I was shocked when Biden even said it, because I was thinking, you do not want to aid and abet anything that looks like military takeover, especially since these are the same Democrats that were so offended by what happened with the marches in front of Washington
when right.
they walked across the street with the upside down Bible. You know, right. I mean, this you can't pick it when it works for you and then blame it when it works for him. And that's exactly what Joe did. And that was totally inconsistent with, I think.
Not a good idea. Upside down Bible.
Not a good idea.
I heard someone say, well, I have mayonnaise, right? You have mayonnaise in those squeeze bottles. Upside down is good because it comes out quicker. So upside down Bible, apparently the verses and the scriptures come quicker if you turn it upside down.
That's, God.
President Trump knows what he's doing with the Bible, I'll tell you that.
It's not the same St. James version. It's the Hellman's version.
It's the Hellman's version. That's right. Exactly. But, you know, the thing that we know now from various people in the administration is that the ballots are not the only problem and the cheating, but it is also the insurrection that is going to happen, and for which people have to get guns and arms because those are going to be scarce, which we've heard before, and be ready. And if the military stepping in is a bad idea, telling people they arm themselves and be ready to actually engage in conflict is an even worse idea, because I grew up in Latin America, may I remind you, Arnie, where that also happens. And when the military steps in, very often then the armed people in Latin America who are very well armed go out on the streets, and you begin to see lots of dead people and lots of chaos, and the economies freeze because, you know, it's so dangerous out. All of these things are something that Americans should think about. You know, we don't want to go there. It may seem like, well, you know, one group is really well armed and has a lot of powerful weapons. No, that's, first of all, not true. There are probably just as many Democrats who have good guns and a lot of ammunition stored away. And you don't want people shooting in the streets because, as we sometimes have seen, the armed forces or the police are underfunded. And if that happens, it's the people with the guns that take over the streets.
Nobody wants that.
Nobody needs that.
The whole thing is shocking. There are two more huge stories. One is obviously what's happening on the West Coast.
Yeah. You know,
this is like Washington and Oregon and California.
Yeah.
I mentioned that the fires might last actually even through the winter, which is just unbelievable. And that the fire season now used to be sort of this discrete couple of months, but now it is actually getting longer in so many ways. It's beginning earlier in the summer, right. It's lasting longer in the fall, that the kind of rain that happens only happens in the winter, not when you need it to fight the fires. We had a young woman on, a writer for, I believe it was from Slate.com, who wrote a piece, and she lives in Oregon. And the one thing that terrified her was that we would forget about them, that they would not be part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that the level of devastation is hard to comprehend. You are looking at places where we're talking about Silicon Valley. We're talking about places where you get your avocados and your almonds and your grapes and your wine.
And your lettuce.
And people keep thinking that the only thing they grow out there are liberals. And as she said, it is an economic engine for the country. The people that should be caring about what's happening in California, Oregon, or Washington are Mississippi and Alabama and Kentucky. Because when you begin to realize, as the blue states, as Donald Trump refers to them, are being trashed, it is the blue states that write the biggest checks that pay for things like Medicaid, that pay for things like Medicare. I mean, we are so stupid because the truth doesn't come out. And now you're looking at a level of devastation that frankly is going to be not in the billions, I don't believe. I think it's going to be in the trillions because of what you're going to have to do to not only just relocate people, where are our entire towns going to go? And what are people going to do when everything is covered with ash?
No, it is apocalyptic. It is upside down Bible shaking out, you know, the plagues and the pestilence. It is incomprehensible. And then, of course, the answer is that those liberal governors should have sent people out to rake the woods and clean up the dead leaves and twigs in the woods, and then there wouldn't be any fires. I mean, I've watched a little bit of it, and I'm still shocked that we're fighting these kinds of fires with a bunch of men and women dressed in heavy gear, walking around with shovels, trying to stop the fires. I mean, isn't there a better way to stop fires? There has to be. Isn't there, I read an article that said we haven't invested in those tanker airplanes that can squash a fire before it spreads in decades. They're all old, rotten airplanes. We have invested nothing in that. But then, of course, the state legislature, to be honest with you, Arnie, they're a bunch of bozos as well. The California state legislature spent a huge amount of time debating and finally passing a law that prohibits discrimination against people for the hair that they have, their hairstyle. And they spent a lot of time on that. I don't know how much time, because I have tried looking at it. How much time did they spend talking about what can we do to better prepare and respond to, and in the future prepare to deal with these catastrophes? I don't think as much as they did on this issue. So there is this distortion of priorities that is shocking. I mean, you know, I of course I think people shouldn't be discriminated against, but don't you have a list of things? This is more important. This is more important. We got to do this.
No, we never do what's more important until the crisis. Everything is, I mean, that's been the story of climate change.
Yeah.
We've been talking about climate change since 1970. A lot of people have been predicting this. And, you know, as Bill Curry says, they were saying that people are suddenly going, oh, my God, it's here, Stefan. And that's what is so depressing. So let's talk about vaccines before I let you go. I heard Redfield talking about the vaccine, about it not being ready until, I guess it's with the CDC or whatever, not being really ready for like prime time until sometime next summer or next fall. But he did say what I've been saying over and over again, that the use of a mask is a crude vaccine. And here is how I want to connect it to California, Washington, and Oregon. They need masks now, not just because of COVID, but because of all the pollution in the air. And the kind of masks they need are N95s, N95s. That's what they need. We should have been producing N95s for everyone in America, but we were fighting the mask fight. And now it's not just about COVID. Now it's about fire and smoke and pollution. And look where we are. We're behind the eight ball again.
And it's incredible. And even in New England, the smoke from the fires is beginning to affect the sky, and people are beginning to smell smoke and ash and particles in the lungs make people more vulnerable to COVID. So there is a kind of synergism between the fires and the plague. Let me respond to your point. The legislatures in Oregon, in Washington, and in California, they have had gigantic fires before. They didn't really do very much. My mother-in-law, may she rest in peace, always was furious that they weren't laying pipelines from the Pacific Ocean into the forests with gigantic sprinklers that when the fires broke out, they could basically put them out. She said, why aren't they doing anything? They're waiting for the fire, and then they're sending a bunch of people in there to try to put the fires out with shovels and axes and dropping some stuff from the air. That's not helping much.
Well, let me just say something. There's a couple of things that should have happened. One, we should have probably underground all the electrical wires.
Yeah.
You knew that 2 years ago, it wasn't because someone was having a party that caused the flames to do it. It was because of the sparking and whatever from the electrical grid. That should have been done, but you know, it was too expensive. Like, this isn't too expensive. And then we allowed people to move more and more outside of the urban areas,
yeah,
into where, into these remote areas, and that's not helping. But the saddest part about this whole thing is that California, Washington, and Oregon have been the most aware about climate change. They have really been the drivers on a lot of the alternative energy, on electric cars, on a lot of these things. And that is the great irony, is that they have really been more, how do I say, they've embraced the concept of climate change, and yet they're the ones that have been torched. I mean, it just seems like it just seems so criminal in so many ways that they are so aware, and now where are they? They're burning. And on that note, I need to let you go. Every other week, we join Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics from Iowa State. He is now a professor emeritus, which means he's busier than he was before, but not directly in the classroom. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks, Stefan. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Talk to you next week. You just